Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy. I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Cass?
Mad because I've had to spend money on stuff, but other than that, I'm great. We're joined by a super special guest, one of my favorite reporters in the entire world, Nick Day, who works at CoinDesk and has been covering the Sam Bankman-Fried trial in person, like Mr. Morris, David Z. Morris, who we had on before. Thank you for joining us today. There's a lot we could start with here. I think we should start with kind of the beginning of the week. Gary Wong's still on the stand, and how it seemed to be not going great at the end of last week, and then at the end of this past week, it still seemed to be going bad. But what was the deal with Gary this week? What kind of questions was he answering?
Gary Wong, one of the FTX insiders, he was a co-founder, former chief technology officer, answered a lot of prosecution questions about, you know, how Alameda was able to access funds from FTX customers and have a negative balance on FTX, how it was able to, in his words, place trades slightly ahead of other parties on the platform. I assume you're asking about the cross-examination from the defense, where questions were somewhat, let's say, more repetitive and less insightful, I think is maybe a fair way to describe them, to the point where the judge was even asking the defense counsel to get a move on multiple times. Those questions were a lot more focused on just kind of the, you know, certain details of what he was testifying about, details about his cooperation agreement with prosecutors.
Let me pause you right there. What was that cooperation agreement, just in case anyone is unfamiliar with what that was about and what that entails? Because I think the thought from a lot of people on Twitter or X, whatever, but the public in general, is that Gary and Caroline, who is the other star witness this week, but that and Nishad for next week and some of these other executives, that they're going to do no prison time whatsoever. But that isn't right. Is it?
You're right. So Gary Wong, Nishad Singh, Carolyn Ellison all pleaded guilty to charges between late last year and early this year, basically saying, admitting to, you know, things like wire fraud and conspiracy charges similar to what Sam Bankman-Fried has been charged with. And what they agreed to do is testify before the court in exchange for a letter from the DOJ to the judge overseeing their case, which I believe is the same judge overseeing Bankman-Fried's case, Judge Lewis Kaplan at the moment, basically outlining their testimony, their crimes, and what has happened. And their hope is that the judge will take all of that into consideration and grant them a more lenient sentence. You know, in Gary Wong's case, he was very upfront about hoping he does not get any prison time whatsoever. But it is up to the judge's discretion. The DOJ is not going to recommend a sentence. They're not going to recommend, you know, not a sentence. They're just going to say, okay, here's what happened, and here's what he said. It's uncertain.
We don't know.
You know what exactly they'll get. Right. We're not going to know until the judge, you know, comes out and says, okay, here is what I think, and makes a ruling. That's, you know, not happening until after this trial, of course. So it's going to take a while.
Well, and as we mentioned last week when David was on, the one thing that invalidates these agreements and makes them liable for full prosecution would be lying. So they can't do that.
And that actually extends beyond just, you know, the three of them. We also have two witnesses, including former FTX developer Adam Yedidia last week, who are testifying under a grant of immunity. So they're not charged with anything yet, but what that means is the DOJ will not charge them for anything they say on the stand or that they admitted to in, you know, the depositions or conversations prior to taking the stand, as long as, you know, with that same caveat that Bennett just mentioned. If they lie about anything, you know, gloves are off, the DOJ can do whatever they want, which is a point that the defense counsel really, really, really emphasized during the cross-examination of Mr. Yedidia for quite a while, leading everyone to think, oh, maybe they have something that they found him lying on. And that did not turn out to be the case, at least as of, you know, right now.
They're saving it for later in the trial, I guess.
I know how silly that sounds, but I guess this is a good time to bridge into the other key witness of this past week, and the one that, man, everyone is talking about in one way or another. Caroline Ellison, the co-CEO, then CEO, but not really CEO, of Alameda Research, took the stand this week, and it has been kind of crazy. I honestly have no idea where to start. Bennett, if you want to throw a question out there about it, It's been so wacky.
There was a lot of details revealed in Carolyn's testimony. And Nick, You've been there. What struck you the most from her testimony so far?
She was testifying for, you know, across 3 days, but roughly it was about 2 days worth of testimony. Throughout the entire thing, you know, she just really gave off this impression of someone who had, you know, unwittingly fallen into this kind of emotionally manipulative, somewhat abusive relationship with someone who was able to take advantage of her and, you know, have her, in her words, do crimes. You know, whether that was having Alameda take funds from FTX customers, whether that was lying about Alameda's balances and, you know, the assets and liabilities to, you know, documents that they sent to lenders and to, you know, other parties, investors, or whether it's just, you know, the whole collapse of everything. You know, she really kind of, you know, emphasized over and over again that she was doing these things at the direction of Sam Bankman-Fried. And prosecutors did bring up her relationship a little bit. The defense mentioned it briefly. And she was talking about how, you know, in her view, Bankman-Fried was not particularly emotionally available for her or give her, you know, any attention. You know, there were some weird details about things like, you know, FTX potentially working with Modulo, which was run by a different individual that Bankman-Fried had been in a relationship with prior. You know, that seemed to be kind of the impression she was going for. And I think she did convey that. The other thing that really struck me is DOJ walked her through a number of issues, and they spent quite a lot of time on things like balance sheets, which are kind of dull, but also I think, you know, substantially more significant than some of the other things that she mentioned. You know, it was a very clear narrative. They had a very clear case that they were presenting to the jury, not just from kind of like the emotional aspect, but also just kind of the fact-based, here's what happened, here's what happened next, and here's how we got to today.
I was actually going to chime in really quick and say, I wonder if, did it seem like the jury understood how important balance sheets are in a case like this, or did everyone's eyes kind of gloss over?
I actually have not been in the courtroom itself for that part of the testimony. Basically, there's an overflow room a couple floors below the main courtroom where most people are able to watch the trial. So there's only about, I think, 20 or so reporters and members of the public who are in the actual courtroom. According to one of my colleagues who was in the courtroom, the jury was, let's call it, you know, split. Some folks were asleep. Some folks were paying attention. Some folks were really looking for things that stood out as being different from the rest of the monotony of people saying things and answering questions. In my view, the balance sheet stuff was some of the more significant and, you know, detailed stuff. So I imagine those who were taking notes are probably going to be filling in those who weren't when they, you know, break for deliberations in a couple of weeks.
One of the most interesting things for me was what she revealed about FTX Ventures, which was basically that it was Alameda Research in a poorly fitting trench coat, where Sam Bankman-Fried had come to Carolyn Ellison and Alameda Research with this idea to do about $3 billion of additional venture investing, but he was worried that Alameda's brand was no longer any good, and so he was going to do it under the FTX brand with FTX Ventures. But what Carolyn testified to was twofold. One, the money for those investments was coming from Alameda Research and therefore indirectly from FTX customers. And that what was more interesting is that Sam Bankman-Fried first approached her to discuss how this investment would, or these series of investments would, change the riskiness of Alameda Research. Can you talk a little bit about that part she testified about?
Yeah, and I actually thought this was a really clever approach from the DOJ as well. So a quick bit of background. In his opening statement, defense counsel Mark Cohen said that, you know, FTX and Alameda were, in his words, a plane being built in flight. And so, you know, in his opening statement, he pretty explicitly, you know, laid the blame at Carolyn Ellison's feet, saying that she did not hedge Alameda's risks when she was told to by Sam Bankman-Fried. So fast forward to her on the stand, the DOJ prosecutors walking her through this. And, you know, this was an assistant U.S. attorney who's been leading the case for, you know, the last 9 months or 10 months or whatever. First talked her through the analysis that Ellison did about whether or not those investments were safe. And Ellison testified that, you know, in her view, based on the analysis, it would not have been wise to, you know, put those further $3 billion into venture investments. And we spent a lot of time on that, talking about, you know, what the risks were, you know, what exactly the, you know, possible failure scenarios were. You know, there was talk about whether or not things like asset prices collapsing, crypto asset prices collapsing might have an impact. And at the end of all of that, the prosecutor asked, okay, so what happened then? And Ellison testified that Bankman-Fried basically ignored her, went ahead with FTX Ventures a couple of months later, and fast forward to November, and you know, all of the failure scenarios presented came to fruition. So, you know, first off, obviously, the obvious is that, yes, these were some bad investments and some bad decision-making that led to this collapse, but also it really kind of undermined a key point of the defense argument that, you know, she had not hedged risks, because Ellison testified that they couldn't. There was no money left to hedge the risks with, because it was all going into this venture investing. And yeah, I thought it was a very clever, slightly subtle, but very clever way for the DOJ to approach that, because, you know, if the argument is, oh, Ellison ignored Bankman-Fried, you know, they kind of said, well, yeah, that's not actually true.
What I kind of appreciated about it is Sam Bankman-Fried, in a series of public statements and by passing certain frames to certain people, has tried to portray, since the collapse of FTX, Carolyn as at least in large part responsible, and her ability as a trader in part driving that. And there have even been specific claims made, like you mentioned there, about the risk management of Alameda and who was responsible for it. And so what I thought made it particularly powerful is that this was a point where you see her, or at least her testimony suggests, she laid out these series of risks, and we see some of the signal chats to support that. And Sam Bankman-Fried took that, which ended up being the actual thing that happened, and said, no, we're going to do my trade instead, in this case, $3 billion additional dollars into illiquid venture. And that, in a significant fact, contributed to the immediate crisis in November when FTX and Alameda Research collapsed. The broader criminality existed regardless of that specific moment, but like, it illustrates that Sam Bankman-Fried was in control and is not as good as he wants people to believe.
Right, exactly. That was, you know, I think a key point in that, you know, the argument that the DOJ is making. I mean, you know, the DOJ's case at the heart of it is Bankman-Fried took money from his customers. But, you know, having all of these other details come out, and for it's for the jury, right? And the question is, you know, how's the jury going to take, oh, well, Bankman-Fried is saying that Ellison is responsible for all of this, but also he was ignoring her, her recommendations on how to, you know, be more careful with the money, while also telling her to do X, Y, Z. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, if you look at the exhibits, you know, besides the signal chats, there's these documents that Ellison put together where literally it's, you know, a list of like, you know, issues and concerns, and pretty stark visual, because again, these are from when she was making these documents back in, you know, 2021, 2022. They're contemporary documents that are illustrating what she was saying, not just, you know, a recollection from, you know, 2 years later.
We've made mention of balance sheets already. Could you speak to the 8 specific balance sheets that Carolyn was asked to prepare?
Yeah, so this was a really wild document, and I had a field day with this one personally, as a personal individual, not as a reporter covering this case. So 2022, some of Alameda's lenders, and specifically Genesis, which is a subsidiary of my employer's parent company, Digital Currency Group, for any viewers who are unaware, was asking for some kind of confirmation of Alameda's balances, which is, you know, seems to me a fairly straightforward request. So at the time, Alameda had a, you know, we've been talking about this, a lot of money tied up in things that they weren't really supposed to have money tied up in, or that they, you know, weren't really paying off, and had already at that point borrowed billions of dollars from FTX customers. And Ellison testified that, first off, she made a balance sheet that acknowledged that Alameda was borrowing billions of dollars from FTX customers, but she didn't want to say that Alameda was borrowing billions of dollars of FTX customer money funds in the balance sheet. So, you know, they used euphemisms like exchange borrows or FTX borrows, FTX loans, you know, things like that, which are, you know, supposed to hide kind of what exactly it was. Even that was not enough. She said she was talking with Bankman-Fried about this, but she created 7 alternate documents or versions of this balance sheet that all appeared on this one, you know, what looked like an Excel document that basically phrased things slightly differently, kind of moved numbers around to try and hide that there was a $14 billion liability on Alameda's balance sheet to make it look like it was in a much stronger financial position than it was. So, you know, the key thing here is, first off, they wanted to hide that they were borrowing billions of dollars from customers, but also that they owed billions of dollars to anybody. So They created these 7 alternate documents, and this is for mid-June 2022. So, they only presented with Ellison the one document with the one primary thing and 7 alternates, and said that eventually they went with alternative 7, which was sent to Genesis and reassured them to the point that, you know, they were able to continue, you know, doing whatever. One thing that didn't come up with Ellison, but that did start coming up later with, you know, witnesses like BlockFi, Zach Prince, they kept doing this. They kept making these balance sheets that they kept sending out, like the ones sent to Genesis. These balance sheets were also modified somewhat to try and hide the full, you know, the full exposure that Alameda had, the full liabilities on their balance sheets. Because, again, if you're telling your lender, oh, yeah, like we owe, you know, tens of billions of dollars of funds to our sister company, probably, you know, it wasn't a good idea. What they were trying to do is prevent the lenders from recalling their loans and saying, all right, well, we want all our money back, which worked for a time until it didn't.
You know what I find pretty interesting about this, and I wonder if maybe this is the defense's only mechanism here. I know that there were these 8 balance sheets, but then last week when we had David Morris on, we talked to him about how there were different internal balance sheets as well. So like the balance sheets that were supposed to be the real numbers, nobody even knew what those were. So like 8 different balance sheets for everyone else. I mean, you don't even have one for yourself. So is there like a level of insane incompetence here? Negligence, criminal negligence, and is that the position they're trying to give themselves, as opposed to like intentional fraud, intentional money laundering? Like, we're just a bunch of stupid idiots. Is that the goal here?
I mean, again, you know, Mark Cohen's opening argument, this was a company that, you know, in his words, made mistakes. Where the phrase he used multiple times, I think, was they were building a plane while flying it. Which, as an aviation enthusiast, is not quite how planes work. This is a personal opinion. It's really called out. Like, they had no.
It's a personal opinion that airplanes while you're flying them. I don't know if that's a personal opinion. Yeah, that might just be fact.
I'm also laughing because I made a joke about that line from the opening argument in my newsletter too, where I was joking about like if their defense is that they're overconfident and stupid enough to jump from a mountain and try to build a plane before smacking into the ground, then yeah, sure, that's what FTX was. But as you said, that's not conventionally how most of aviation has been done.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's there. He was like saying like, oh, well, they don't have a chief risk officer. They, you know, Bankman-Fried was, you know, present until he was, you know, stepping away to do other stuff, you know, namely FTX versus Alameda. That is their argument, is that, you know, all of this is like a, you know, horrifically tragic mistake caused by, you know, whatever, building too fast, moving too quickly,
underwear,
you know, getting too big. Yeah, you know, whatever. What is it that Facebook had? Move fast, break things.
Yeah.
That's kind of the impression that, you know, Mr. Cohen is trying to present. And I will say, you know, and Judge Kaplan has repeatedly expressed his admiration and respect for the defense counsel, but it is, based on what we've seen so far, a tough case that they're going to have to defend. And we'll see what the defense actually says. But so far, yes, their argument seems to be it was not deliberate. FTX funds just happened to get loaned to Alameda, and then things collapsed, you know, because of attacks from crypto media and, you know, whatever, attacks from rivals of FTX. Yeah, these are all things he mentioned in his opening statement that they've, you know, we've seen, again, documents, Google documents from Bankman-Fried and his team. They kind of suggest, yes, that is a narrative they've been trying to figure out since November of 2022.
Attacks from the crypto media is also funny to me because they're referring to, I think, your organization's work, yeah. Nick, if I had to take a guess. And Business Insider recently published a recording of the all hands at Alameda that Carolyn Ellison held, like, as the collapse was happening. And one of the things she said during it that struck me was she's like, honestly, I'm amazed this balance sheet didn't leak sooner. We've been sending these around to lots of people. What would have been particularly bad for her is if different versions of that started leaking, because they were making a lot of versions, as we've now thoroughly established.
This is the part where I lost my mind in court. Like, you know, is obviously, you know, CoinDesk had this moment in November 2022 where we published a balance sheet and the details of a balance sheet, which ultimately led to everything. What we realize is that first off, you know, the insinuations that the balance sheet was leaked by specific parties to CoinDesk, those are, as far as I understand it, not accurate regarding, you know, how my colleague Ian Allison was able to source this document. We, you know, we did the whole authentication thing. We verified it in ways that we were very comfortable with. And then now I'm wondering, like, hang on, did a doctored balance sheet meant to make FTX and Alameda look healthier than they were still manage to collapse this entire thing?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, that's...
Because the balance sheet from that you guys reported on accurately reported on some of their FTT holdings, but did not include any of the, like, inter-party loans or the loans to executives.
Right. Exactly.
Again, there's no way for them to ever have provided an actual balance sheet to anyone. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
right,
there is no real fucking balance sheet. It's all just made up bullshit in their minds. I don't know. It is wild. But yes, you're right. Yeah, it collapsed. It still collapsed it, even though it was a more positive take on FTX and Alameda Research, which is absolutely...
And, like, also was testifying, like, you know, they were looking for accountants and auditors, and they were having a little bit of difficulty there. So that's why she, as a trader, who... She's my age. So someone who went from being a trader to being a co-CEO to being a CEO of this company was putting together balance sheets, taking over the role from a fellow former FTX executive, Ryan Salem, who was the CEO or co-CEO of the Bahamas entity. And yeah, that seems to have been their internal accounting. We haven't heard anything so far suggesting they had something more sophisticated than, you know, Miss Ellison putting numbers into a Excel document or a Google sheet.
Not that this is going to play a role in any juror's mind or anything, but I will say that when I heard what she was getting paid and that she had almost no equity in anything, I know she got that big fat $20 million bonus or whatever, but to have pretty much no equity in a multi-billion dollar business, in air quotes for anyone not watching, it just seemed like he was being a real piece of shit towards her. You know, I don't know what that says. That's if everyone would be in prison if you could go there for doing one bad thing. But yeah, it just seems like, you know, Liz Lopato, who I brought up before, did an article which I don't know the exact line from it, but it was something like Sam Bankman-Fried was a shitty boyfriend, which I like. I don't know. It doesn't say anything that's criminal, but gosh, he just was a jerk.
Yeah. Look, I love Liz, and I, you know, going back to what I said at the beginning of this, that was kind of what Ellison was saying throughout her testimony, is that, you know, she was in the situation where Bankman-Fried was, you know, paying her base salary was like $200,000 per year. She had the bonuses, you know, $20 million bonus, which is nice, quite nice, but she didn't have equity in Alameda. She asked for equity in Alameda, you know, when she was named CEO, and that did not happen. You know, Bankman-Fried denied it ultimately, and she still did all of these things that are, you know, that led to her pleading guilty to multiple federal criminal charges in December and then testifying this past week before a jury and like 100 reporters and members of the public. So, yeah, I don't know what that says, but it is a little wild.
So we've talked about some of Carolyn's notes. Nick, do you have any thoughts on $150 million for the thing?
That was... I will say that was part of one of my favorite lines said. So, you know, the back and forth here, you know, you may have read parts of the transcript or you may have seen the quotes quoted, but it's hard to convey in text just the kind of the intonation, right? So you have the assistant U.S. attorney asking Ellison, you know, okay, did you ever speak in coded language about crimes that you committed or that crimes were being committed? And Ellison said yes, and the prosecutor asked for an example, and Ellison said, well, there was a time we might have, what was it? We bribed the Chinese government or government officials with $100 million. And the prosecutor, complete deadpan, well, let's break that down. And again, some of us were in the overflow room. The overflow room kind of burst out laughing. It was such a surreal kind of moment that, you know, to answer your question about what that actually was, you know, Ellison testified that, you know, Alameda funds on, what was it, Hobie, now known as HTX and OKX, were frozen, tied to investigation about a user of the exchange, not an investigation into Alameda itself, but into a user who's, I guess, using Alameda funds or an Alameda account. And they had a couple different things that they tried to get those funds unlocked. First, they hired a lawyer to try and unlock the funds, and that did not work. So then they hired, and this is where things get really weird. They used identity cards or identities from prostitutes to try and engage in a trading, plan to basically move the funds, not like directly off of, you know, the exchanges from Alameda's account to whatever, but to try and lose the funds and then make the funds back. And I'm explaining this poorly, but regardless, that didn't work. So then they tried bribing government officials, which apparently did work. And she testified that it was $100 million, but then later she created a document where, you know, they were talking about recent expenses and assets and whatnot. And they had, yes, a line item saying 150M for the thing, which is code for we think we might have bribed the Chinese government.
Yeah, so just for a little color on that scheme that Nick mentioned, funds had been frozen for withdrawal, but their accounts were still allowed to trade on these exchanges. So they had a scheme where they were going to open new accounts using stolen identity documents from these people. And then they were going to engage in a series of losing, like, wash trades with these accounts that they would also control. And these accounts were still allowed to withdraw, and in doing so, they'd be able to get the funds off the exchange. As Nick mentioned, that was unsuccessful, and thus began the process of transferring somewhere in the range of $100 million in cryptocurrency to what is now believed to be Chinese government officials. Just for that added color. Cass, you were going to say something?
Oh, I will say, this is what is interesting to me. I don't know if you guys remember, there was a rumor or a screenshot going around that there was a wire fraud chat between all of these people. And I would assume that would be submitted as evidence. No, I haven't heard about that getting submitted at all. That maybe isn't going to come up
yet.
Not that specific chat. We've seen other Signal chats. You're right.
Right. Yeah, we've seen like the small group chat, which was FTX insiders. And interestingly enough, I'm not sure if this has been, you know, talked about much, but Bankman-Fried's father, Joe Bankman, yep, was in that chat too. So we've seen that chat. We've seen a couple other chats that were mostly just, you know, Ellison and Bankman-Fried or Bankman-Fried and Singh and Wong. But yeah, we have not seen wire fraud pop up yet.
I wanted to mention one of my favorite lines that Nick and his co-author and friend, who we're also hoping to have on the show soon, Danny Nelson, reported that the judge was getting frustrated with line of questioning that they were going through about SBF kind of being in charge, and one of the attorneys said that it would take 10 minutes to ask these questions, and the judge retorted, quote, some people don't have 10 minutes left to live.
This judge has some of the best lines. He's got such a dry sense of humor, but
that's incredible to me that, like, that clearly the repetition and the questioning from these lawyers, I don't know if it's on both sides or if it's mostly just the defense, but he is not having it.
He's taking zero nonsense. And I will say, I haven't taken a formal tally or anything, but it does seem to be a lot more against the defense than the prosecution, to the point where, you know, he's even at points dismissed the jury for a break and then held, you know, the lawyers back to say, stop doing this to the defense attorneys. And that was, I think that was last week.
It was. The first sidebar with Cohen to tell him to stop being repetitive was on the first day of actual questioning after jury selection ended.
That sounds right. It's all blending together. You mentioned my colleague, Danny Nelson. We had a moment the other day where we were like, oh, this thing happened last week. No, it didn't happen Tuesday. So time is doing a thing. But yeah, he's said that, you know, without the jury, he said that in front of the jury. And, you know, one of the things that kind of gets me is, like, if, you know, the jury is like 12 random people plus six alternates. It's, you know, 18 random New Yorkers plucked from their day jobs who are already, you know, some of them are clearly not happy about being on the jury. Some of them, you know, have already, like, complained about having to move plans around and losing money and things like that. And so they're going to probably be looking at the judge to, you know, kind of explain, oh, well, you know, these people are all talking. Should we be listening to that? Should we be paying attention to that? And they're seeing this judge snap at the defense attorney saying, like, you know, keep, you know, stop repeating these things, move on, move forward. And, you know, the line that, you know, Cass cited, that was during a sidebar, so the jury did not hear it. But they've heard a lot of parts where the judge has been very just, like, visibly and audibly annoyed at the defense attorneys. And to a lesser extent, some prosecutors, but primarily at the defense attorneys, which is a real, you know, I'm curious to see how that factors in when they get to deliberations.
I know I've been reading a lot of articles about this trial. Yeah, I get my point being, even though most of them say pretty much the same thing, which is what the hell is the defense team doing? They're really blowing this case. It's not looking good for them. Are we all in for a crazy moment in the next few weeks where we all go, that's what they were doing? Like, there has to be a bombshell here, right? Like, this is, it just seems like the defense team, everyone is just like, they're doing a really bad job.
This is the thing that I'm wondering too. First off, so we haven't actually seen the defense really kick in yet, right? All we've seen so far is an opening statement and a cross-examination of the first set of witnesses. And it's really just cross-examination we're all going off of, because the cross-examinations, you know, the assumption I think a lot of us were making coming into this is, if you're a defense attorney and you know that your clients, you know, best friends, ex-girlfriend, key business partners are testifying, part of your goal might be to try and undermine their credibility, to, you know, demonstrate, oh, well, you know, this person is only saying what the prosecutors want them to say, because otherwise, you know, whatever, they're going to go to jail. So, you know, you want to get that impression of, or, you know, that these people were not, you know, competent. They were not doing what they were supposed to be doing. And that's why, you know, things fell apart. We didn't really see that happen during the cross-examination of, you know, Gary Wong or Carolyn Ellison. We saw a lot of repetition. We saw a lot of confusion where, you know, Ellison finished up her direct testimony to the prosecutors on, I want to say it was Wednesday. I'm pretty sure it was Wednesday. So we had a couple minutes where the defense had an opportunity to start. The first question was about an internal accounting, or how they labeled an account for internal, you know, tracking purposes. And it took them like four tries to get the name of the account correct, to the point where Ellison was confused, the judge was confused, the jury was, I assume, very confused. And the judge just said, all right, you know what? We're just going to cut it early here and, you know, move on. Or like, we'll start again tomorrow. It's been a long day. So I think that's where a lot of these questions are coming from, about what the defensive strategy is. And we're seeing, like, you know, utter hints about this from, you know, filings and stuff. But we'll see for real when the defense starts, probably in the next 2 weeks, to make their case and try and present their defense. But yeah, so far the impression has been one mostly of confusion.
I think we may all have to grapple with the possibility that this is on the order of magnitude of the best possible defense Sam Bankman-Fried can get, just rooted in the things he did and the way they're documented and who has already agreed to testify against him. You know, at a certain point, like, defense attorneys can only do so much, you know? When you have six people sitting there all going, it was that guy who told me to do this thing, and here's the chat where he told me to do it, you run out of options in terms of what alternative set of facts you can try to present to create a compelling narrative for the jury. You know, you get kind of boxed in by your own behavior when you're Sam Bankman-Fried.
That is absolutely a possibility here. And this is another line that the judge said that, you know, was kind of funny, is like, right after Ellison finished her cross-examination, the judge was like, okay, yeah, you're going to try and, you know, impugn her character, and that's your job. You know, I'm not criticizing. I know that's your job. Like, even the judge is acknowledging, like, okay, here's the one possible strategy, or here's a possible strategy that you can get into, and you're doing it, or whatever, you're trying. So, yeah, it's definitely, based on what we've seen so far, I think a difficult case. And again, going back to what I was saying about the DOJ having, like, a narrative, they have a narrative. Their narrative is Sam Bankman-Fried wanted to take FTX customer funds for personal purposes, and here's all the people he told to, you know, change things or do things that would allow him to do so. And the defense has so far not had an opportunity, or, you know, not even tried, I would argue, to present a competing narrative that bolsters their argument that it was all, you know, just a mistake, or, you know, an inevitable collapse caused by, they didn't say incompetence, but, like, it's a little implied there.
It's funny because I keep reflecting on, like, I didn't initially think this would even go to trial, to be quite honest. I thought Sam Bankman-Fried would have the wherewithal to plead guilty. Then I thought, even up until a couple weeks ago or a week ago or so, maybe he'll still plead out because, you know, I mean, things aren't looking good. And then I realized at some point, like, he's far past the point of no return. And it all goes back to his, like, effective altruism kind of gambling ideas, where it's like, okay, if I do plead guilty, there's no, like, I cannot return from that. I'm going to go to jail for whatever, 25 years, let's say, or something, with a maybe a chance for a little bit less if he pled out right away, maybe 20 or something. But like, that is a significantly long time for a 30-year-old man who wants to change the world, right? So he goes, okay, well, then I would prefer, even if there's a small chance, to get no time at all. So he's going to go for that. And then when that fails and he gets way more time than he initially could have, let's say 30 to life, then he still has appeals that he can do, like all the way up until the Supreme Court. And for each one of those bets, he's like, well, I have some chance. I have odds that I can possibly effectively do an appeal, effectively do something to get out of this prolonged period. And then that's where I'm like, oh, he's not gonna, there is no pleading. There is no, like, this is gonna go all the way to the end. He's gonna get sentenced. He's gonna appeal. He'll appeal to the damn Supreme Court if he has to. Like, he wants to get off on whatever he can. And I'm like, I'm fully understanding it now. I'm just like, oh, okay. I had Boy Genius wrong. Like, he's a grown man who doesn't understand, like, actual risk versus reward in any sense.
There was a telling moment early on in the trial. One of the prosecutors told the judge, they had, it sounded like just one single early conversation about whether or not a plea deal should be discussed. And there was no interest from the defense. And so that was it. They did not have any other discussions. And, you know, adding to your point, obviously they're not going to say this, but my guess is prosecutors are also kind of in this viewpoint of they got everyone else to flip and plead guilty. So now they have, you know, one person who they can, you know, this is a pretty high profile case. They're going to, I assume, try and make an example out of them. And, you know, if they win this, then it's a nice feather in their cap to end the year with. I assume they're not going to say this, and we'll deny it fast. Probably.
So next week, are we supposed to see Nashad soon? Is that who's next, Nashad Singh?
So we don't have the exact order of the witnesses, but we know that he is among the next seven or so to be called.
Okay.
And like on a logistical point, so there's no trial on October 20th. That's the Friday after we're recording this. Or the Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday after that. And prosecutors expect to wrap up halfway through the first day back from that break. So, yeah, I think chances are good. We will probably start to hear from, you know, Nashad Singh, who is another, you know, inner circle, another, you know, former fellow executive. Yeah, we should hear from this week.
Okay. And then we just have the defense after that, right? And closing arguments?
Yeah. So defense expects to take about a week and a half by their estimates, which takes us to, if they start on, you know, midway through October 26th, then that'll probably take us to like the second week of November. And then closing arguments, which I assume are probably not going to be super long. So by the end of the second week of November, we might be well into, you know, jury deliberation / verdict areas.
It's going to be exciting. It has been wild. And like, I have noticed significant uptick in everything for all cryptocurrency related stuff while this trial has been going on. Great to have you on, Nick. If there's any other color you want to present for the courtroom and we should link to one of your sketches. You've been doing a number of sketches in the courtroom that really do a great job of expressing how it feels to be there and to be a witness, I guess.
I'm so happy that people are... I literally just started as like a joke. I was like, oh, well, you know, whatever. We're waiting for things to happen. Let me just sketch, you know, things happening. And I sent it into like the CoinDesk Slack. And then next thing I know, they're like on Twitter and in articles and like everyone else is doing it. It's very fun / cool moment, but also like it's very funny.
I want to say, by the way, freaking Bennett got put into he's exhibit 849 of this trial, which good for you, Bennett. I'm very proud that you are a piece of evidence in this. And I've heard that other reporters that were there noticed and enjoyed that evidence getting submitted.
Turns out Sam Bankman-Fried does control Alameda Research. I was right and he was wrong. well, thank you very much for joining us, Nick.
Thanks for having me. Yep. This was fun as always, and great to see you too, as always.